In the legal world, knowledge is mostly shared through the written word, in briefs and judgments. But true wisdom, that's passed from person to person over time. Welcome to Elephant Echoes, a podcast that provides a platform for Bowman's legal veterans to pass their wisdom to the next generation of lawyers. I'm Bianca Masterton, a knowledge and learning lawyer in Bowman's Johannesburg office. As organizations such as Bowman's grow, evolve, and adapt, there is a risk of institutional knowledge being lost over time. This podcast is inspired by the great elephant herds and their complex and caring social structures. Our most experienced practitioners share their knowledge, skills, and insights as to how to become outstanding lawyers with flourishing practices. In this episode, John Bellew, a senior consultant based in Johannesburg, shares how he became a pioneer in private equity law.
I've got to go way back to the beginning for a bit and then look at some of the things that happened to me, some of the things that I think helped me to be successful. But I think when I look back on my career, a large part of it, and I think this is bad news for you, a large part of it is down to dumb luck. Being in the right place at the right time. And there's not much you can do about that other than you choose how you respond. And I think I've done that reasonably well. And I think for me, being in the right place at the right time started off before I even did my articles. I interviewed at a number of Joburg firms and I was going to go to Cliff Decker. And then one of my friends who was doing articles at Weber's said to me, "John, don't be crazy. Come to Weber's because we have an office in Luxembourg. And if you do well here, maybe you can get an overseas secondment." And that was enough to change my mind. So I signed up with Weber's. And I joined Weber's at a really turbulent time in South Africa's history. 2nd of January, 1987. It was a Friday, the day after New Year, but they made us come to work. But it was the time of the state of emergency. It followed the Rubicon speech of P.W. Botha in 1985. South Africa was burning. There was conflict. We were deploying people into the townships. We were effectively in a civil war of a low-scale nature. And a lot of the scope of the struggle happened within the employment arena because there was so little political space for people to express their will. And I joined Weathers and I was immediately put into the employment law department, the labor law department, as we called it. Labor law was embryonic. Weathers decided to go into it. They had a young partner by the name of Rod Harper who set up the department. They didn't entirely trust him. And so they took a much older litigation partner and put him in alongside Rod to provide some structure. And I worked for that man. His name was Derek Reed. And I learned an enormous amount from him. And I think for me, that's one of the themes of my career is that you must learn from the people that you work with. And that's good people and bad people. You need to learn what your style of being an attorney is going to be. And to do that, you need to see what other attorneys do that works for you and what other attorneys do that don't work for you. Anyway, I went to work for Derek Reed. It was an exciting time. The miners' strike was in full swing. And I think in our department, we brought 46 high court interdicts and won 45 of them. I remember as a young, literally 3-4 months into my career, being helicoptered to some of the Anglo-American mines to actually go and sit with the management and draft the papers for the interdicts that we would then bring. I spent 8 months in the employment law department. We did 3 rotations of 8 months at Weathers, not 4 of 6 like we do at Bowman's. And I also got to argue a court application, which I won in the labor court. And Rod Harper came to me and he said, "John, we'd like you to be, when you finish your articles, to come back to us in the labor law department and we will make you our effective in-house counsel." And I thought that was a really grand idea because I guess I'd always harbored ideas of being an advocate. And so that was what I thought my career path would be. My next rotation was in litigation, fairly undramatic. And then my final rotation was in the Weber Wentzel Media Law team, which was part of the corporate department at Weber. It was headed by a man called Peter Reynolds. His senior associate was Paul Jenkins. He's now the CEO of Caxton. And it was, by some stretch, the leading media law practice in South Africa. And again, it was exciting times. There was extreme press censorship under the threat of emergency. And my day job was really taking articles from journalists and seeing how much of those articles we could publish without falling foul of the emergency regulation. And then there was a litigation piece of actually taking those regulations and trying to have them set aside, which generally proved to be a futile exercise in an era of great conservatism. So two really exciting rotations through my articles. And at the end of it, the head of what we call the Professional Services Committee made me an offer to stay on in the media team. And I looked at him and I said, I really appreciate your offer, but I'm going back to the labor law team and I'm going to be a full-time labor lawyer and I'm going to be in-house counsel. He looked at me and he said, I've just offered you the plum job in the firm and you've turned it down. What's wrong with you? And I said, well, this is what I want to do and this is what I want to be. And he said, fine. And I went back to my office, and about 3 hours later, Derek Reed, who I'd worked for in the labor law department, phoned me up and he said, don't be an idiot. He said, take the job in the media team. He said, labor law is exciting, but I think you're the kind of person who's going to need more. And I'm not very good at listening to people, but I respected him highly. And I thought, well, if that's what he says, he knows much more than I do. And so I went back and groveled and took the job in the media department, where I worked for 2 years doing sort of media law and also a certain amount of corporate law, but really for the large media houses. And then I was lucky enough to be offered the secondment to Luxembourg, which was the reason why I had originally joined Weber's in the first place. I went off to Luxembourg as a freshly minted senior associate. My secondment was for a year. My attitude was that it was not my long-term career and that I should really do as much as I could to explore Europe, have a good time, and learn. And I did. I read as widely as I could, but I also learned a lot from the partners in the Luxembourg office of Reddit, particularly in relation to international tax structuring, international offshore centers, and the use of international offshore centers. Yeah, basically the whole structuring that went around that. Some partnership work. There was a little bit of fund work there as well, but it wasn't really the focus of what we did. Now, I stayed in Luxembourg. My secondment was for a year. At the end of the first year, they asked me if I'd like to stay for a second. I said yes. And yeah, I mean, I had a wonderful time there and I learned a lot. And incidentally, I overlapped with Andy Pike, who was in the office at the same time there. But I think Luxembourg taught me two things. It taught me, first of all, there was a guy there called Steve Jogala, who was a young partner, but he was probably the most creative and innovative lawyer that I had ever worked with in terms of how he regarded the law and what he used law for. He used law as a tool to achieve commercial objectives. And for me at the time, it might seem obvious now, but I never really thought about law in that kind of way. But he used law, he designed structures, and he used law in order to achieve his clients' objectives. And for me, that was an instructive lesson and one that really shaped how I saw my role as an attorney. The second was I had a really bad experience with one of the partners in the Luxembourg office. He called me into his office towards the end of my 2 years at Convent, and he said to me three things that I'll never forget. He said, John, there are three things that are required to be a good attorney. He said, you need intellectual ability. And he said, yeah, you're quite a smart guy, so you tick that box. And he said, you need attention to detail. He said, frankly, your attention to detail is appalling. Look, he may not have been wrong about that, but it wasn't good news to hear. And he said, thirdly, you have to have the ability to attract and retain clients. And I've worked with you, and I just don't ever see you doing that. And that was it. And I walked out of there. I was fairly stealth up until that point in my career. I thought of myself as being successful and being on the right path. And here was this man who'd now told me that basically I was in the wrong job and I was a failure. And I think the lesson when people say things like that to you is that you need to take them on board. You need to analyze them. You don't need to accept them and you don't need to agree with them. You need to learn from them and you need to be resilient and you need to come back stronger. And I didn't agree with a lot of what he said, but it was clear to me that I didn't want to spend any longer in the Luxembourg environment. They had offered me a full-time job, but I wanted to come back to South Africa. I believed in the transition that was happening. This was at the end of 1991. I saw great things ahead for the country. I felt in Luxembourg that my skills didn't make a difference, and I felt they would make a difference back home. And so I came back home at the beginning of 1992. Never regretted it until Chris Hani was assassinated and we got over that. I came back to South Africa and didn't go back to the media team. I went to work for Peter Arthur, who was the sort of senior corporate partner at Weber's. And I started doing more pure corporate law work. And I got lucky again. I got lucky with Peter. He was a great mentor. He was a great lawyer to work for. And he gave me opportunity. And he introduced me to what in those days was called First Corp. It was part of First Rand. It ultimately became Ethos. And he let me loose on a transaction with Ethos, which was one of the first BEE transactions in the market. And it was a difficult one because I think it was 1993. There was a lot of political violence in KZN between Inkatha and the ANC. And this BEE deal involved a catering company based at that point down at KZN. And the two BEE parties, which had been shortlisted or engaged, I suppose, were Kagiso Trust, aligned with the AMC, and an IFP-aligned investment house. And we had to put together a deal with two BEE parties whose principles were largely at war with each other. And we managed to do it. It was an incredibly fraught negotiation, but we put together a very successful transaction. Company's name was Supervision Food Services. It ultimately became Compass, and I think it's still around today. But I learned a lot through that. I learned the manager in charge of putting it all together was the most incredibly wise man who had the ability to bring people of diverse groups to a common position. And we succeeded, and the deal was successful. But at the end of that, the transactor from First Corp said to me, "Wow, John, you're going to get all our work from now on." And that is how I became a private equity lawyer. It was a response to a lucky opportunity that was given to me that I made the most of, and I seized. And I think there is a real lesson in there for young lawyers. So after that, my practice really took off. I didn't have to do much more. There was a lot of private equity work around in the early 90s. Once we became integrated back into the world economy, a lot of the big conglomerates that had been built up over the years decided to focus on their core businesses, and they disposed of their non-core businesses, often to the management team with private equity support. So literally there was almost more work than I could cope with, and that carried through right through probably until around about 2008. You know, I really didn't have to do a lot of BD. There weren't many private equity lawyers in the market. So, you know, I was the default guy. I wasn't competing with 6, 7, 8, you know, equally competent players in the market. Weber's cornered that market from early on. And that, you know, again, was luck. It was responding to luck, learning about myself and learning about my clients and what I thought needed to be done to be a successful attorney. And when I think about it now, you know, we're in a much more competitive world. I think it's much more difficult to build a practice than it was when I did. But I think because we were in this elevated air of Bowman's, we operate at the very top end of the market, and all our competitors bring a similar set of skills to play. The lawyers who sit in Weber, E&F, Cliffdecker, Bowman's, we're all good. In fact, we're all excellent, technically. But technical excellence is basically just gets you in the door. It doesn't mean that you're going to be successful, because that's what everybody brings. So there needs to be something else that makes you successful. And for me, I think it goes to a few things. Partly it goes to your ability to build relations, but you can do all the BD in the world and you can bring in the most fabulous client. But if you do a lousy job, you're done. So you have to be able to deliver. You have to back yourself to deliver. You have to make your client believe that you can deliver. Because if your client doesn't have confidence in you, again, you're not likely to get a repeat instruction. You need to be practical. Well, being able to deliver an excellent commercial view and opinion, to be able to plan a negotiating strategy, to be able to see the end point at the beginning of the journey. I think these are some of the things that set good lawyers aside, apart. The ability to, you know, and attention to detail is important. But equally important is the ability to see the big picture and not get lost in the weeds. And that ability to sort of elevate yourself and have a bird's eye view of your matter, of where you are in the matter, what you need in the matter to make you successful, and what your end goal is in the matter, that is key, to my mind, to being successful in your practice. Then I think you need to be innovative. Many of the structures used in private equity today were drafted or conceived by me. Those include the sort of standard partnership agreements that we use and various others. So become known as an innovator, become known as someone that you can rely on for that. Then I think, you know, there's obviously the question of your personal integrity. You have only one reputation, and it's difficult to build and easy to lose. And you need to guard that reputation really fiercely. I remember also as a young lawyer, I was instructed by a guy who walked in the door and he sounded plausible and he was in the pharmaceuticals industry and we were doing a deal. And I rushed ahead, and at one point the attorney on the other side came to me. I was maybe arguing my case perhaps over vigorously, and he said, "John, just be careful." He said, "This guy is a crook. His drugs come off the back of vehicles, and, you know, he may sound plausible, but he isn't." And I thought, well, you know, no, it's very improper for the attorney on the other side to be saying this kind of thing to me. But I didn't discount it completely. And then I started to notice things about my client that weren't quite right. And so, you know, there was a man, he was a much older man than me, but he took the time to kind of give me some input that was really valuable in the context of that transaction. How do you build practice? So I've said, for me, a lot of it related to being in the right place at the right time and then grabbing the opportunity with both hands. But I think there's certain key attributes that are likely to make you successful. And that's, you know, whether it was me in the early 1990s building a practice, whether it's you guys looking to build practices, the tools you use may be different. You know, we had no cell phones, we had no social media. So the way in which you go about communicating yourself may be different, but I don't think the fundamental principles change at all. And I think there are a couple of key things. But firstly, it's really important to listen to your client. Listening is a hugely underrated skill for lawyers, and I believe it's one of the most important skills that we have. If you don't listen to your client, you can't understand your client's business, and therefore you can't design a solution which is appropriate to your client. So spend much more time listening than you do talking, at least in the early stages of the matter. Secondly, you have to be interested in your client's business. You have to learn about your client's business. You have to go out of your way to learn about your client's business. And you have to show your client that you're interested in his business or her business. People like to feel that you're interested in them. It's a common human thing that we all deal with. So showing your client that you care about the business, you're interested in the business, you want to learn about the business. Importantly, you want to go and visit the business, because once you visit the business, you know, it helps to entrench you in all kinds of ways. And, you know, I would often go to a client, walk through the corridors, come back with 3 or 4 instructions. That's the relationship that you want to build. You need to be interested in your clients as people too. You know, we sort of talk about clients in the abstract, but every client, at least until ChatGPT takes over completely, is a human. And, you know, deal with them as humans, no more, no less. Don't build them up into something they aren't. Treat them with respect and be interested. I think you should always under-promise and over-deliver for your client, and it relates to internal clients too. There's nothing more frustrating as a partner than having a junior promise you something which is then not delivered on time. Not okay. Then you need to make your clients look good. You know, if you're dealing with the general counsel, make him look good. Make him stand out in the eyes of his bosses when he delivers an excellent result that you've helped to achieve for him. Be confident, even if you don't feel confident. Be available. The job that we've chosen is a tough taskmaster, and you will have to give up your weekends from time to time. You will have to work through the night from time to time. You will have to take calls on holiday. It will demand sacrifices from your family, but it comes with the turf. And then I think for me, and this is maybe just me, there's absolutely no room for ego. I cannot stand prima donnas in any way, shape, or form. Be they my partners, be they the people who work for me. There's no room for ego. You're part of a team. You're delivering for a team. And set yourself aside. So I think those are what I would say you should do. I think you must, even as a young lawyer, reach out to your peer group, because the peers that you interact with now are going to become the chief executives and the chief financial officers of the future. And you need to build relationships that you can grow with through your practice. One of my clients has been my client literally since 1989. He was a junior when I first met him on a transaction, and he's now, you know, the chief investment officer of a private equity fund. He would probably have been the CEO of RMB if he hadn't emigrated. Those kind of relationships are pure gold, and you can't replace them. Take opportunities to build your profile. You know, have opinions, stand out in the workplace. Don't be afraid to express your opinions. I think one of the things that perhaps annoys me most about Burmans is that we probably don't communicate with each other as much as we should. You know, partners meetings are staid affairs. Wiggers was very different. Partner meetings were robust affairs. We engaged with each other. And I think you have the right to expect certain things from the firm. And that means for us as partners, we have the obligation to open doors for you. Ultimately, your career is your responsibility, you know. You can't shy away from that. But I do think that you should be exposed to quality work. And I think it's important that you're exposed to clients on a repeated basis. It doesn't help if you work today for client A, tomorrow for client B, and then the next day for client C, because you need that sort of regular exposure in order to build the relationships and to start developing the relationships that you can take over. I think it's incumbent on us as partners to be generous with our clients and to see the clients as Bowman's clients, not our clients. Too few of us do that. But you've got to give opportunity to people and allow them to respond. We need to have this mindset of liberating people. We go into the market and we employ the brightest and the best. And then all too often, we don't enable them to be the brightest and the best in the workplace. And I think we can do a lot better about liberating people and helping them to be the best that they can be. I think the other thing that I would like to say is that it's really important for you to be prepared to be involved in the firm in the broader sense of the word. For me, that's a really important part of being a partner. And it can start before you become a partner. One of the things about Webers was that there was a missing generation in South Africa. So when I joined, there were a lot of partners who were in their 70s and in their 80s. And there were a couple of partners, fresh partners, who were maybe in their 30s. But there was no one in that critical sort of 45 to 55 year band. And that was because they were all sitting in Luxembourg and London and Guernsey, where the offshore offices were. And that created, it meant there was a vacuum. It meant that there was a lack of mentorship. But it also meant there was a world of opportunity because as a young lawyer, we were doing things that typically we wouldn't have done for another 10 years. So we were being exposed to responsibilities. But it also meant there were opportunities for us to get involved in management. And a number of us did. And we shook the Weber Wenzel tree very hard. Nikki Newton King once stood up at a partnership meeting at Weber's. Nikki was the CEO of the JSC for a long time. And she said, Weber Wenzel is an elegant but leaking ship. And that was probably the best way I could have described it. It was a club for gentlemen. We didn't ask difficult questions. We had good clients, but we gave very little thought to our business. And a group of us changed that. There's a chapter written about us in the history of Weber Wenzel. We were called the Young Turks or the Young Turns, depending on who you were speaking to. But we fundamentally changed the direction of the organization over a period of about 3 or 4 years. And being able to make a positive contribution to take your business forward and to leave it in a better place than you found it is, I think, a responsibility all partners should bear in one form or another. And so I would urge you to not be shy of having a voice and of being prepared to stand for leadership. I think it's usual for young people to join a firm and to, like Bowman's, and to feel overwhelmed. And, you know, if I look at my background, my parents were teachers. They didn't own a house until they were in their 50s. They never owned a share on the stock exchange. They knew a lot about Shakespeare, but they were very unworldly. I went to university. I had no idea that a thing such as a corporate lawyer even existed. So going to Weathers was a bit of a shock. And I remember working for Paul Jenkins and having a question, and he said, well, why don't you phone the client? And I said, but the client's in London. And he said, well, so what? Anglo-American can pay. You know, that was the level at which I approached. An international phone call is a terribly expensive thing in my world. And I had no experience of the fact that, well, you know, Anglo-American doesn't really mind paying for the odd international telephone call. Learn, take the opportunities that are offered. The very fact that you work for Bowman's is already a vindication of your ability and your success. Believe in yourselves and take it forward. And finally, I would say, you know, if I look at my 22-year-old self walking into articles for the first time, and I look back at myself getting towards the end of my career, if you had told my 22-year-old self what I would have achieved and where I would have ended up and what I would have, how much I would have enjoyed the practice of law, if I'd worked with wonderful people, I'd had intellectually stimulating work, firstly, I probably wouldn't have believed you, but secondly, I think I would have been very happy with what I had achieved, and I'm grateful for what I achieved. And I do approach it in that light. And I do think that Bowman's offers you the ability to be more than you can perhaps imagine when you start out.
Thank you, John. So incredibly insightful. Just listening to you speak gave me a great sense of calm and comfort. Let's open the floor to questions.
There is a question in the chat from John asking, how did you build professional confidence?
It was partly because I got a cum laude law degree, which I never thought I was going to get. I was amazed. So that kind of told me I was on the right track. And I think it was just where I was in life. I'd been 6 years in an all-male boarding school. I'd just come out of 2 years in the army, and I was done with having people tell me what to do. And I was simply determined to make the most of it. So, you know, and I think it's your attitude. I think you've done your law degree, you've succeeded, you've got articles at one of the top firms, or you've been engaged by one of the top firms. You simply have to accept that you've got the basics in place. You know, if you spend your time focusing on self-doubt, it's never going to work. Professional confidence, yeah, I mean, I'm not a particularly sociable person. I'm a very introverted person. I hate going to conferences and having to smile and wave at people for 3 days. It's probably the worst thing about my job, but we have to do it. And I think it's about being determined, it's about your attitude, it's about being resilient, and it's about, damn it, just get out there and do it, you know? Adopt the Nike logo. How did I build professional confidence in my clients? How did I build confidence in my clients? It goes to listening, being considered in the advice that I give, being creative, building the trust that I can solve whatever problem that they put in front of me. That's, you know, some people want to be trusted advisors, and I respect that. I didn't. I always wanted to be the rocket scientist. Gugu, who or what has been your greatest motivation or inspiration? My biggest motivation, I think, was I was very much a Lark Lamaki in my family. I arrived 15 years later after the younger of my two siblings. My parents weren't entirely happy about it, but it meant that because they were teachers, they didn't have any money really. They were still paying for me to go through school and university when they should have been retired. And there was no safety net for me. There was no plan B. If I didn't make it, I was going to starve. And, you know, for me, that was probably compelling to be successful and certainly drove me. The greatest inspiration, I think I've just learned from people. You know, I've met wonderful lawyers all through my life. Derek Reed, Peter Arthur, Stephen Jogala. Those are the people who have inspired me. I'm not one who reads a lot of self-help books, but I would recommend to every one of you to read Good to Great. I think it's in the library, the book by Jim Collins. And it's very interesting because many of the really great leaders who've built really great businesses have not changed their lifestyle one iota. They remain humble. They remain down to earth. They live in the same house. And it speaks to the whole point about there's no room for ego. You know, be comfortable with what you've achieved, be proud of what you've achieved, but don't get too big for your boots.
I just wanted to ask whether, I mean, do you have anything that you would do differently or any major regrets?
No, I do. I definitely do. So I think I would be a nicer human being as a young lawyer. You know, I kind of alluded to the change that we went through at Webbers, that driving that change required a lot of energy, and perhaps I was too abrasive. I believe I was known as John Bellicose by my partners, my senior partners there. One of the things we did was we cut the retirement age at Webbers to enforce a 65-year retirement age. And what I didn't realize at the time was that the partners that we were forcing to retire had no intention of retiring and had made no provision for their retirement. And to go from being an equity partner to being a consultant put a serious dent in their back pocket. And I think I could have handled that differently. I think I could have been a bit less abrasive. I think I've become less abrasive and more mellow as I got older. But equally, I think, you know, I think if you're an M&A lawyer, you need an edge, and you need to be able to do tough things, make tough decisions, have hard conversations. But I don't regret that, but I do think that finding the balance is important, and I don't think I've always stayed on the right side of the line. Definitely not.
John, what would you still want to change at Bowman's, if you could?
I think Bowman's is an absolutely wonderful firm, and I think, you know, having left Webbers because I was deeply unhappy in my team and with the toxic culture in my team, that culture is probably for me the most important aspect of the law firm, and I think Bowman's really does get that right. But I think, you know, you've always got this tension between culture and the business imperative, and I think of Bowman's as a Formula One motor vehicle, where the driver isn't really pushing the accelerator. And I think for me, that relates to clients. I think it does relate. I think it does mean that partners need to take a bit more responsibility, because I think we're a bit complacent. And I think for me, getting rid of that sense of complacency and really getting the most out of this incredible brand across our offices, there's so much opportunity. And I think for the next 5 years, that's where we need to focus.
Just wanted to ask for, like, I don't want to say younger lawyers and be ageist, but like lawyers that are just starting with their careers, what is like the one piece of advice you'd be like, you should just do more of or lean more into? And one thing you should definitely avoid that would, you know, you think would be like a kiss of death for their career or something.
So the one thing you should definitely do as a young lawyer is to make yourself indispensable. You know, your clients, when you first start out, are not external, they're internal. Don't ever underestimate the value of your internal reputation. So anything that I said you need to do externally, you need to do internally. You need to under-promise and over-deliver. You need to be excellent. You need to be a safe pair of hands. You know, I sometimes joke and say, you know, your job as a junior is to make my life easier. If you make my life more difficult, then that's a problem. So don't tell me you're going to give me something tomorrow. I tell the client I'm going to give it to them tomorrow, and you tell me at the end of the day, well, sorry, I'm not going to do that. You know, you need to be that safe pair of hands that is creative, and you need to make yourself the go-to person internally, whether that's in your team, whether it's cross teams, cross departments. Be the person that people want to put on their matters as the junior, because that's how your BD starts. I always say, if you have no work, it may be our fault, but it may be your fault, because maybe you aren't making the effort. Maybe you aren't hungry enough. Comes back to your career as your responsibility. Get out there and make it happen. But I think for me, that's the key internal piece. Build your internal profile and your reputation. The DAO, what you absolutely shouldn't do, in my book, yeah, you know, I've said it often, but I have no time for ego and I have no time for prima donnas. And if you behave like that in my team, that is the kiss of death as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you, John. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate you giving us your time to speak today. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
If you would like to get in touch or find out more about Bowmans, please visit bowmanslaw.com.